The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Glomerulonephritis Diagnosis and Management is presented by Dr. John Pryor.
So when I was in school, I have to say that this was one of the more confusing things that I ever learned. Pathology was, you know, I read the pathology of glomerulonephritis, and I said, and we went through the pathology, and then I looked at the differential diagnosis of each of the histologic types, and it was the same damn differential diagnosis every time. So what good is that for me? So I'm going to try to give you a clinical approach that you can use in life and in boards. All right, let's see if I can get this to work. Okay, good. Okay, so we're going to do some rapid cases here. So this is a very nice 44-year-old woman who showed up to the hospital because she had not been feeling well. She had dyspnea and hypertension. She was really sick for about 3 to 4 months. She had recurrent episodes of bronchitis, you know, from late fall into the winter, and just never got better from it. She really had no past medical history. She's very healthy, no family history. And her primary care doctor eventually did some labs on her. And at least on physical examination, she was hypertensive, so that got his attention. She was a little bit tachycardic, and she was wheezing. And lo and behold, her BUN was 61, and her creatinine was 3.8. So that gets our attention. So I was taught by a guy who said, a disease is a disease if it affects the kidney. All the other ones aren't important. So this person obviously has something happening to her kidneys. White count was a little bit high. She had some eosinophils. That's always interesting to us. She had a lot of protein, a lot of red cells, and some white cells. And then microscopic-wise, she had a urine protein creatinine ratio of 4,000 milligrams. So she had 4 grams of proteinuria, and of which 3,300 of it was albumin. So the bulk of her proteinuria was albuminuria. And I'm going to show you a chest x-ray. Not that amazing. Like, you know, of course, I'm a nephrologist looking at this, but I'm not that impressed with her chest x-ray. So she was admitted to the hospital, and we did a urinalysis on her, and this is what her urinalysis looked like. So these are red cells and red cell casts. So we always look first for the red cells in the urine. Those are the nice round things. We also look to see if they look normal. Some of these red cells look like they're a little bit dysmorphic. And that sort of tells us what the cells are in the cast. And if you look right and left side, it looks like a peripheral smear with schistocytes and Burr cells and Helmet cells. That's what's called dysmorphic red cells. So dysmorphic red cells mean that the cells came from the kidney. So what's her diagnosis? Could she have lupus? I guess. Could she have IgA vasculitis? I guess. Could she have this eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis? I guess. Could she have mixed cryoglobulinemia? I guess. Could she have microscopic PAN? I guess. So just from the start, any of these diseases are certainly possible. So it's really like, so just from her presentation, you really can't tell. But is there an approach to this? So first off, when we think of glomerular disease, we think of two things, right? We think of hematuria or proteinuria. So we put these people into two categories. If you have hematuria and proteinuria, those are people that have proliferative glomerulonephritis. And in medical school, we learned that as nephritis, right? And then there's the other group that just have proteinuria, right? And that's just, and then we thought of those as the nephrotic syndrome group of people, okay? So based on their presentation, we tried to put them into one of two categories. Do they have proliferative glomerulonephritis, hematuria, and proteinuria, or do they just have proteinuria? So this woman obviously had hematuria and proteinuria, right? And so what's proliferation mean? It just means that there's round cell infiltration of the glomerulus. And it goes in a relatively orderly fashion, okay? It starts in the mesangium, then it goes into the endothelium, which is the capillary. So some of the endothelium are affected, that's focal. Some parts of the endothelium are affected, that's segmental. Then it goes to the hull of the endothelium, that's called diffuse. And then it can break through the endothelium into the epithelial side, that's called crescentic. So Mark showed you pictures of RPGN where you see proliferation outside the glomerulus. That means the inflammation has gone from the mesangium all the way through to the epithelial side. So the histology of this really just determines severity of disease, right? So when I was reading about mesangial GN and I was looking at the differential diagnosis and I went to the next one, which was focal and segmental glomerulonephritis, next one diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, and I saw the same list of disease every time, that's really what confused me. So all these diseases can cause these types of lesions in the kidney. It just depends on how severe the inflammation is, all right? So obviously biopsy doesn't necessarily tell you what disease they have. So what we've had over time is this clinical approach, and it's really easy because it's just you ask two questions. Question one is, does this person have a systemic disease or do they have just glomerular disease or just kidney disease? And the second question is, what are their complements? So for example, our presentation of a woman who had respiratory symptoms and felt lousy for 3 to 4 months, she has a systemic disease, right? So I know which group of diseases can cause systemic diseases and cause disease in the kidney. And my next question is, what are her complements? So if we do divide them by whether they have a systemic disease or whether the complements are normal or not, we can put them into categories. So now we're getting someplace. At least we can kind of start to figure out what people could have. So this woman who has systemic disease, she's got lupus, she could have mixed cryo, she could have post-infectious, she could have good pastures. She could have granulomatous polyangiitis. She could have IgA vasculitis. She could have microscopic polyangiitis, or could she have eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis? So those are the things we're dealing with. So the next thing we would do would be to send off complements, and then the complements would help us put them into a quadrant. So just quickly, we'll go through some of the diseases. So lupus is the prototype, right? This is, everybody knows about lupus. Lupus is an autoimmune disease with immune complexes that get deposited in the kidney. If the disease is mild, it's mesangial. If the disease is severe, it's crescentic. So we can see people anywhere from just a little bit of hematuria and proteinuria to renal failure from this disease. They also have some other iterations of this allergic interstitial nephritis and also membranous, but not so important as that. The workup for this is always going to be an ANA, a double-stranded DNA, and an anti-Smith, right? So there is no such thing as lupus nephritis if your ANA is negative. I buy that some patients with lupus are ANA negative. None of my nephritis patients are ANA negative, okay? So they always have to have a positive ANA. And this is a low complement disease. They usually have low C3 and C4. Mixed cryoglobulinemia is kind of an interesting disease that we do see to this day. Mostly we see it with hepatitis C, but we also sometimes see it in the setting of an immune proliferative disease, such as people that have monoclonal proteins. So sometimes with the lymphoma, sometimes with myeloma, these antibodies are cryoglobulins and they precipitate out, so they can cause disease in this. And this is another proliferative disease. If it's mild, it's mesangial. If severe, it's crescentic. So there's usually three types depending on whether it's monoclonal or polyclonal. Not so important. More important is what do we see it from? So we see it with hepatitis C. And the interesting thing about hepatitis C is if you do anti-hepatitis C antibodies, they are cryoglobulins. So if the lab draws a hepatitis C antibody on them, and they go draw from 5 other patients, and then they go to the lab, by that time the antibody's precipitated out and they're antibody negative. So if you suspect this disease, you have to actually do hepatitis C antigen by PCR. So you have to actually look to see if they have viral replication. You can have post-infectious glomerulonephritis. Now, this is a disease that mostly affects the kidney, but the infection causes systemic illness. So the most common one we see nowadays is staph, okay? So you have staph endocarditis, you have staph osteomyelitis, you have a staph soft tissue infection, and then 2 to 3 weeks after the staph infection, you start to develop worsening renal function, and you look at the urine, they have hematuria and proteinuria. But there's a lot of different diseases that can do this. I mean, many different infections can cause this. And they typically have low C3. The last case we had was a guy who had right-sided endocarditis in the setting of a VSD and had staph bacteremia. 2 to 3 weeks later, while he was being treated for this, he developed renal failure. And when we looked at his urine, he had hematuria and proteinuria, and we said, ah. So we sent complements off him, and the complements were low. So that's, and then we actually finally biopsied him. All right, so how about just plain kidney disease that's low complement? Post-strep GN is the classic one, and we'll talk a little bit about post-strep GN because that's a pretty common board question. And then there's the thing called membranoproliferative proliferative GN, which is kind of a confusing set of diseases, but we'll talk real quickly about it. So post-strep GN is just you have a strep infection. In adults, it's usually soft tissue infection. 2 to 3 weeks later, you start to develop hematuria, proteinuria, and hypertension. I was first introduced to this in a 12-year-old kid when I was a first-year fellow, and we got called to see this kid because he seized. And he seized because his pressure was 150. His pressure had never been 150 before. And when we looked at him, he had hematuria and proteinuria, and he had low complements. And so he had post-strep GN. So, and just had, you know, it's just like pregnant women. You don't have to have pressures that are 200 over patent pending for you to have hypertensive encephalopathy. If you've never been hypertensive, some elevation in blood pressure can cause symptoms. As far as the labs are worthless. Who hasn't been exposed to strep here? So almost everybody has positive strep antibodies. And then finally, there's the membranoproliferative proliferative disease. And I don't think that this is fair game for boards, except in one case. And the fair game in boards is hepatitis C. So besides hepatitis C causing mixed cryoglobulinemia, it can also cause this thing called membranoproliferative GN as well, okay? There's three types. I don't know how important it is. It depends on whether they have immune complexes or complements. There's an interesting disease, which is the second type, which is called dense deposit disease. You actually have antibodies to C3, and the antibodies to C3 cause this disease. Okay, now we're over to the other side, okay? These are systemic illnesses that have normal complements. So good pastures is the prototype. Mark talked a little bit about some of these things. We'll go through them quickly. So good pastures, so what's interesting about good pastures? Good pastures is that there's antibodies to the NC1 region of type 4 collagen. This happens to be the Alport antigen. So if any of you guys know hereditary nephritis, Alport syndrome is a deficiency of this Col4A35 type 4 collagen. So interestingly enough, if you take somebody with Alport syndrome that has renal failure, and you transplant them, and the body has never seen that antigen in its life, it can develop good pasture syndrome in the transplant, which sucks after you've been through all that. So I would say that this is an uncommon disease, something that we see every 5 years or so, and it's for some reason you develop antibodies. So, and the thing that we see is sometimes it presents like a vasculitis. They've been sick for 3 or 4 months, they don't feel well, they've been dwindling, they're anemic, they really don't know what's wrong with them. And when that happens, typically they're oftentimes positive for ANCA as well as the anti-GBM antibodies. And this is just a picture. So you can see, we learned this as either you have linear deposits or the lumpy bumpy deposit of immune complexes. But basically there's just an antibody that's directed to a glomerular basement membrane antigen. The vasculitis are probably the more common things that we see a lot. There's three different types. Four different types. They're all small vessel vasculitis, right? So the glomerulus is a small vessel. It's got a capillary going in, a venule going out, and a small vessel. So if you have small vessel vasculitis, it can affect the kidneys, okay? Now this is if you look at this and you remember back to medical school, none of these names will sound familiar. None of these names will sound familiar. What's happened is there was a group of pathologists that initially described these. They happened to be German pathologists. They happened to work during the Second World War. They happened to have performed sort of acts that we really don't aren't proud of. So they've been kind of banished, so their names are gone now. So what we used to call Wegeners is now called granulomatous polyangiitis. And this is due to an ANCA vest, is an ANCA antibody, and it's actually specifically due to C ANCA, more specifically due to proteinase 3. So it's an antigen within a neutrophil. It's an antibody to the antigen within the neutrophil, which causes causes degranulation and inflammation that leads to this disease. Typically, it's upper respiratory tract, but it can be lower respiratory tract as well. Next one is the thing called microscopic polyangiitis. So you'll know that there used to be polyarteritis nodosa. There was overlap syndrome. Now it's just called microscopic polyangiitis. So these are specifically confined to the kidney, and they're specifically ANCA positive. And when they're ANCA positive, they're always P ANCA positive, and the specific antibody is this thing called myeloperoxidase. So if you know, you might hear in some of the other lectures of other diseases like inflammatory bowel disease that you can have P ANCA positivity. If it's MPO, then that's microscopic polyarteritis. The other P. ANCAs are just epiphenomena. They're seen in other diseases as well. IgA vasculitis, so that used to be Henoch-Schönlein purpura. Now it's IgA vasculitis. So it's an IgA small vessel vasculitis that affects the skin, the small intestine. We don't see this as often as the pediatricians, but we definitely do see this. We oftentimes see this post-staph. So we'll have staph infection, and they'll come to us with skin lesions and GI bleeding, and they'll come to us with arthritis, and we look at their urine, and they have hematuria and proteinuria. So that's used to be called Henoch-Schönlein purpura. It's now called IgA vasculitis. And then finally, there's a thing that used to be called Sjögren-Strauss disease. Now it's called eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis, and typically almost 100% of these people have a history of asthma. And if they don't have a history of asthma, they're wheezing, and they have signs of systemic inflammation that's allergic, so they have eosinophilia, and oftentimes eosinophils in other tissues. So when we had steroid-sensitive asthma that we weaned to leukotriene inhibitors, we suddenly started to see this. And it's not the leukotriene inhibitor that causes this, it's just the asthma and the eosinophilic inflammation that causes this. It acts like microscopic polyangiitis, and they're oftentimes P. ANCA positive, myeloperoxidase positive. So then there's the final quadrant, right? So these are the diseases that affect the kidney that are normal complement. And there's sort of analogs of the upper there. So there's IgA vasculitis, and there's IgA glomerulonephritis. There's immune complex GM, there's anti-GBM disease that affects the kidney only, and there's good pastures, which affects the kidneys and the lung. There's renal vasculitis, so there's GPA, there's MPA, there's EGPA, and then there's just renal limited vasculitis. Have the same markers, but they don't have the systemic manifestations. So IgA, it's important for us to talk about because it's probably the most common proliferative glomerulonephritis in the United States. And the important thing about this, remember, is it's normal complement. So remember we talked about post-strep GN, where that's low complement, right? And remember post-strep GN, the hematuria and the proteinuria appears somewhere about 2 to 3 weeks after the event, where here it's preformed immune complexes with IgA due to a respiratory tract or GI tract infection. So in the midst of the infection, that's when they have the symptoms, okay? So in the midst of the infection, not 2 to 3 weeks later. So here's a pretty typical case. A 25-year-old woman, she's got a respiratory tract, co-committing respiratory tract infection, and she comes up to you and she says, I have dark urine. She might have had dark urine multiple times in the past when she gets sick. Not uncommon for people that have previous gross hematuria with this disease. So your analysis, it's a no-brainer. They have blood and protein, so it must be proliferative glomerulonephritis. Look, they have proteinuria, 2,500 milligrams of proteinuria. They have a urine albumin creatinine ratio of 1,400. Oh, what's the complements? Well, the complements are normal, okay? So that's an important distinction here. Really not systemically ill, normal complements. What's the most likely diagnosis? It's got to be IgA, right? where post-strep GN, this is going to be 2 to 3 weeks after the respiratory tract or soft tissue infection, and they're going to have low complements. Okay, good. Okay, another quick one. So this is, when I see people that have hematuria and proteinuria, my next thing that I look at, so here's the typical presentation, right? Dark urine and rash. Sounds like glomerulonephritis, right? They have a lot of red cells in the urine. They're all dysmorphic. And lo and behold, they also have some proteinuria. They have 1,800 milligrams of protein and 1,200 milligrams of, and their GFR is 30 and their hemoglobin is 8. Wait, the platelet count's 40,000. So every time I see somebody that I think has proliferative glomerulonephritis, my next thing that I look at is the platelet count. Okay? Because people that have TTP and hemolytic uremic syndrome look like GN. And if you don't think of them, you will never diagnose them. Okay? So if I see somebody that I think has GN, I look at the platelet count. And if the platelet count is down, I look to see if I can find signs of microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, which are high LDH, high ALT, low haptoglobin, and I look at the peripheral smear, and the peripheral smear has schistocytes. So this person had a purpura as well. So what's the most appropriate next test? So typically I would say, well, complements are obviously what it should be, but in this case, because they have thrombocytopenia, I want to see if they have a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. So peripheral smear would be the next case. And here's a typical smear with a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. The arrow signs show you that there's helmet cells and Burr cells. And you really only have to have 2 schistocytes per high power field to call it a microangiopathy, okay? So you think GN, they have thrombocytopenia, I have to look at the peripheral smear, okay? So that's always the way we go with this. Good. Oops. Back. Okay. Mark talked a little bit about this. I don't think that this is this is important for you to know, but you don't need to hear it twice. Okay, next person. Here's a person that just shows up with hematuria, and it's painless. She doesn't have any lower tract symptoms. She's 55 years old. Her GFR is normal. She doesn't have any proteinuria. She has no past medical history. She did smoke in the past. Blood pressure is normal. Ultrasound looks normal. There's no, anybody that gets hematuria, we always image. And her urine culture is negative. So the question is, how do you approach this person? Okay? What's the appropriate next test? We've been doing biopsies, we're sending complements, we're doing all kinds of crazy stuff, but she doesn't really have anything else to suggest that she's got glomerular disease, right? So if you have hematuria, and you're over age 50, you get cystoscopy, right? Anybody that's got hematuria over age 50, they have to be cystoscoped, they have to be imaged. We've imaged her, it's normal, she's got to get cystoscopy, okay? If you're over age 40 and you have hematuria, you get cystoscopy. So over age 40 if you're a smoker, over age 50 and everybody else. And the reason being is pretty obvious. We want to diagnose bladder cancer before it becomes a crappy disease, right? So the people I know with bladder cancer either has a nice disease that you can go in and take it out and cure it and follow them with cystoscopies, or people that lose their bladder and die, you know? There's no place in between for this. This is a surgical disease. So early detection of bladder cancer is important. So hematuria, you have to, if you're over age 50, you have to have cystoscopy. Okay, and then there's the thing called benign. So she has cystoscopy, it's negative. So we have nothing to suggest that she's got anything else. I have a group of people in my practice that I see on a year in and year out basis that all they have is hematuria. And they don't have hypertension, they don't have proteinuria, they don't have a systemic disease, they don't have azotemia. So those people typically have a fairly benign prognosis. And if we were to biopsy them, they would have IgA, they would have hereditary nephritis, they would have hypercalciuria, hyperuricosuria, but they typically have a fairly benign prognosis, although a small percentage, less than 5%, will progress, and that's why we bring them back every year, okay? Good. Okay, so the workup is just to make sure that they don't have any kidney, any signs of parenchymal kidney disease. We do cystoscopy, we image everybody. So obviously the next appropriate test is cystoscopy. So one more time here. So we have a guy here who comes in with progressive renal failure. He's got gastroesophageal reflux disease diagnosed 4 months ago, started on a PPI. So PPIs are getting such a bad rap these days, you know. I figured, why the hell shouldn't I pile on with this? Baseline GFR is 80. The current GFR is 22. Well, that gets my attention. UA has some red cells. Okay, that gets my attention, right? We're starting to think about, could this person have glomerular disease? But they don't have a lot of proteinuria. So, and if we would examine him, we'd find out his blood pressure is pretty damn normal, okay? So the pressure's normal, they don't have much proteinuria, but yet they have hematuria. So what's the most likely diagnosis here? Well, I mean, it could be any of these things, although he doesn't have a lot of, he doesn't have glomerular range proteinuria. It's not more than 1,000 milligrams a day. So the distinction between allergic interstitial nephritis and acute glomerulonephritis is somewhat of a clinical decision more than anything else, with a little bit of urinalysis thrown in. The most common thing that's found in people with interstitial nephritis in the urine is hematuria, even to the point that if you don't have hematuria, you don't have the disease. But hematuria is pretty nonspecific, right? So there's lots of other things that can cause hematuria. So hematuria is something that is if you don't have hematuria, we can probably rule out allergic interstitial nephritis. But if you do have hematuria, you're in the ball game. And then all the other stuff is really nonspecific, okay? We learned that this causes rash, eosinophilia, eosinophiluria. That occurs 10% of the time. What the hell good is that? So it's really high index of suspicion with proteinuria that's in the tubular range and hematuria. And those are the people that we considered for interstitial nephritis, and those are the people we biopsy. So this person would have gotten biopsied. Okay. So let's go back to our case. Now you forgot all about her, right? So she's got systemic illness, and we think she's got proliferative glomerulonephritis. We send complements off. They're normal. Okay, so what's that? That's good pastures, vasculitises, okay? Good pastures and vasculitises. Some dummy sent an S-pep and a U-pep, and she's got a monoclonal protein, which confuses the hell out of everybody. She's got a P-ANCA that's suspicious, and she actually has a more specific myeloperoxidase antibody that's positive. That's interesting. So bone marrow was negative for plasma for the criteria for myeloma, thank goodness. Her CT of his chest, I'm going to show you. She had abnormal lungs with decreased confusion decreased confusion passivity, and we actually did a renal biopsy on her. Now, at this point, we think she's got some type of vasculitis, right? Or she's got good pastures. Good pastures antibodies were negative, okay? So we think that she has some type of vasculitis. CT scan shows some nodules. Okay, that's interesting. She's got a systemic illness. This is the biopsy. The biopsy is this surrounding thing around it. Is there a light? Yeah, okay. This surrounding thing around it is, this is epithelial proliferation. This is epithelial proliferation, and this is the glomerulus in between. So this is crescentic glomerulonephritis. And these are all eosinophils. These are all eosinophils. So if we go through this, she had a proliferative glomerulonephritis. She had normal complements. She had what looks like a vasculitis and what she fit into, this eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis. And so that's sort of how we pursued this diagnosis, all right? So you kind of go through it sequentially. Ask two questions. Are they systemically ill or not systemically ill, and what are the complements? And then at that point, you can kind of do directed serologic workup, right? And then typically you can come up with a diagnosis pretty simply. Okay, good. So in the last part of this thing, we're going to talk about the other side. So what is the other side? The other side is, what if you come, when else do you think that they have glomerular disease? Well, it's when they have a lot of proteinuria, okay? They don't have hematuria, they have proteinuria. So here's a 60-year-old African-American guy, he presents with worsening edema. He's only been diabetic for 2 years. He's been hypertensive for 2 years. Isn't that a classic history? Well, what happened to you 2 years ago? Well, I was in a car accident. And I visited the emergency room, and they found out my sugar was high and my blood pressure was high. Or else I had a stroke, and that's when. And so on physical examination, he's got distal polyneuropathy. He's got myeloproliferative retinopathy. And here he's got a urine protein creatinine ratio of 6.6 grams. And he's got a urine albumin creatinine ratio of 4,200. So I want to talk a little bit about this. And so our differential here is, could he have FSGS? He could. Could he have amyloidosis? Sure, he could. He's got polyneuropathy. Could he have diabetic glomerular sclerosis? Well, it'd be surprising because he's only been diabetic for 2 years, but I've been fooled before. Could he have minimal change disease? He could. He could have memories. He could. He could have all these things. I really don't have an answer for which of the five things he could have. So the first thing I want to talk about is using this thing called urine albumin creatinine ratio and urine protein creatinine ratio, and then finally use the ratio, okay? So the ratio is very important. So when you check a urinalysis and you dipstick it, that's albumin, okay? When you measure total protein, that's all proteins, and then you can specifically ask for albumin. Now, we know that people that have glomerular disease, at least 50% of their proteinuria is going to be albuminuria. So if I see somebody's got proteinuria that's more than 50% albuminuria, I can say this is probably glomerular disease. If it's only 20 to 40%, that's what I see with interstitial and vascular disease, so hypertensive nephrosclerosis, chronic interstitial nephritis. And then lastly, if you have a lot of proteinuria but almost no albuminuria, so the ratio is less than 20%, that's myeloma. That's the only thing it can be is myeloma. So you can have somebody present to the emergency room, send off a spot urine for protein, creatinine, and albumin, and have a diagnosis of myeloma the next morning, well before the hematologist ever gets to see the patient, because there's nothing else that does that. So I, when we order these studies, we usually typically order a spot urine for protein and creatinine, and a spot urine for albumin and creatinine, and then our final thing is we set up a ratio, and we said what percentage of the proteinuria is albuminuria. If it's less than 20%, that's myeloma. All right, if it's more than 50%, that's glomerular disease. And if it's someplace in between, that's the typical interstitial disease. So that person I showed you with interstitial nephritis, their ratio was about 35%. Okay? It's not typical of glomerular disease. Forget it. So there's a bunch of different patterns of injury that you can have that in the glomerulus that can lead to proteinuria. The classic one is this thing called minimal change disease. Minimal change disease is called that because on normal light microscopy, you see nothing, okay? So it looks like a normal glomerulus. But what happens is there are alterations in charge within the pores of the glomerulus, so it allows albumin to go through that. So the charge is typically negative. Albumin is typically negative. When you change the charge from negative to positive, it allows albumin to go right through. All right, and this is a electron microscopy that shows the basement membrane here. This is the basement membrane. And these are the podocytes, the epithelial cells. And these are called the foot processes. And what happens when you get massive proteinuria, those foot processes are gone. So those foot processes are what we call efface. So that means there's difficulty with glomerular permeability. Membranous glomerulonephritis is a different disease. So this takes immune complexes that are formed within the glomerular basement membrane. Sometimes it's to one of your own antigens. They've actually discovered this antigen called phospholipase A2 receptor. And this is what probably all primary membranous is due to, is antibodies to this protein. But you could also have it to the prostate-specific antigen, or you can have it to other tumor antigens, or this could be a manifestation of lupus. Those are the secondary membranous, okay? And this is the glomerular basement membrane again. And these are the immune complexes. These are intramembranous immune complexes. Finally, there's a disease called FSGS. And FSGS is a really complex, hard disease to understand because there's so many different manifestations of it. The end result is instead of immune complex formation within the glomerular basement membrane, there's replacement of the glomerular basement membrane by connective tissue. And sometimes it's a genetic disease. Sometimes it's an inflammatory disease. Sometimes it's secondary to other things like shooting heroin or HIV or morbid obesity or sleep apnea syndrome. And sometimes it's just because we don't know. And it's a disease that's really hard for us to characterize and very hard for us to treat. There's a certain percentage of these people that will be treatable with corticosteroids or calcineurin inhibitors, but there's a large percentage that have nothing. So it's a really high incidence in the African-American population, apolipoprotein A1 really makes apolipoprotein 1 mutations really make a huge difference in the progression of this, but that's sort of where we're at with this. So I wish I could give you better information about this. We still have no clue. And if you can see now on this side, this is connective tissue disease. So this is normal glomerulus and this is connective tissue. So it's focal and segmental. Okay, so not every glomerulus, not all the glomerulus. That's focal and segmental. Diabetic glomerulosclerosis is, so there's modification of the glycoproteins because of chronic hyperglycemia and hemodynamic effects that lead to altered glomerular permeability and injury. So typically we say you have to be diabetic for 15 years. It's a clinical diagnosis, duration of disease. Do you have retinopathy? Do you have hypertension? Do you have normal or big kidneys on ultrasound? And do you have benign urinalysis except for proteinuria? That's the disease. So this is called nodular glomerulosclerosis, and that's what this is right here. This also could be look like myeloma too, but this is nodular glomerulosclerosis of diabetes. And finally, there's a protein deposition disease, and Mark talked a lot about this, as a matter of fact. He talked about the complications of myeloma. So a lot of these are diseases that there's protein deposition. It could be a degraded light chain, that's AL amyloidosis. It could be a degraded inflammatory protein, that's AA amyloidosis. It could be an intact light chain deposition disease, or it could be a fragment of an antibody, and that's what fibrillary and immune tactoid disease are. So these are diseases where they have some type of things that's deposited within the kidney. Typically, they're immunologic mediated, almost always monoclonal, and they cause alterations of glomerular permeability, and they cause progressive renal failure. So, and this is, amyloidosis is the first one, and we sort of talked about this. This guy has polyneuropathy. That would be interesting to me, polyneuropathy and proteinuria, because could this be amyloidosis? The workup is as you can see. And Mark showed you a couple of these, so I won't beat you up about these. Okay, so let's get back to the case. So in proliferative glomerulonephritis, you noticed I had a pretty neat way of going about it. I had two questions to ask. My two questions are, do you have a systemic disease? And what are your complements? Okay, that's all I had to ask. And I could narrow it down pretty well after that. With basement membrane disease, I don't have that nice approach. I know there are certain things that are prevalent, like HIV. I know that lupus can cause membranous glomerulonephritis. I know certain types of hepatitis can cause these types of things. But then I'm done. So typically with these people, biopsy is what you have to do. So we biopsied this guy. And this is nodular glomerulosclerosis. So lo and behold, that 2 years of diabetes wasn't 2 years of diabetes. It was probably 15 years of diabetes that was asymptomatic and undiscovered prior to this. So normally if I had the history of 15 years, he never would have gotten near a biopsy needle. And so he had diabetic glomerulosclerosis.